All right, so let's get into some constitutional law today.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever thought about double jeopardy? You know that that you can't be tried twice for the same crime thing.
Yeah.
Well, the case we're looking at today, United States v. Dixon, it kind of throws a wrench into that. It actually went so far as to overrule a pretty big precedent, Grady v. Corbin. And it really reshaped how we view double jeopardy.
Yeah, what's really interesting about Dixon is how it brings in contempt of court into the whole thing.
Okay.
On the surface, you might think, well, if someone's held in contempt for something, that's also a crime. Aren't they being punished twice?
Right.
But it's more complicated than that.
Some real gray areas here.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go any further, though, can you just give us a quick overview of double jeopardy? I mean, everyone's heard of it, but it's always good to get a refresher.
Sure. Double jeopardy, it's in the Fifth Amendment, and it basically prevents someone from being prosecuted or punished multiple times for the same offense. It's a really important part of our legal system. It makes sure things are fair and that the government can't just keep, you know, going after someone for the same thing over and over.
Okay, good, good. So that lays the groundwork. Now let's jump into the two cases that are at the heart of Dixon. First up, we've got Alvin Dixon.
All right, so Dixon's case, it starts with a murder charge. He was released on bond, but there was a condition. He couldn't commit any other crimes. But then he was arrested later for possession of cocaine with intent to distribute.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to a conviction for contempt because he violated his bond terms and separate charges for the drug offense itself.
So it sounds like they were basically trying to punish him twice for the cocaine, once with the contempt charge for, you know, breaking the bond, and then again with the drug charge.
That's exactly it. And that was the argument Dixon's lawyers made. You know, they said the drug charges should be dropped because of double jeopardy. They said the contempt conviction already covered it.
Okay. And then on the other side of things, you've got Michael Foster and his case adds a whole other layer of complexity to this.
Yeah. So Foster was under a civil protection order, a CPO, which prohibited him from assaulting his wife. He ended up violating that order, which, you know, led to a contempt conviction.
Right.
But then on top of that, he was indicted on other separate charges, all stemming from the same incident. We're talking simple assault, threatening to injure, and even assault with intent to kill.
So just like Dixon, Foster is facing consequences for violating the court order and for the underlying actions that got him there in the first place. But here's the thing. The initial rulings in these two cases went in totally opposite directions.
Right.
Dixon's motion to dismiss the drug charge, you know, based on double jeopardy, it was granted. But Foster's motion was denied. So how is that possible?
Well, that's the big question, right? And it's the very reason why these cases wound up in front of the Supreme Court. I mean, you had these two seemingly conflicting outcomes in Dixon and Foster, and it created a split in the lower courts. You had different courts applying double jeopardy in different ways, you know, in these types of situations. The D.C. Court of Appeals tried to sort it out, but ultimately it had to go to the Supreme Court. They had to step in and give a definitive answer.
So the Supreme Court had to untangle this whole mess and figure out, I mean, does punishing someone for contempt, does that protect them from being charged with a crime for the same conduct? I mean, these are some serious stakes.
Definitely. I mean, the core question in front of the court was, does a contempt conviction based on a specific action mean that because of double jeopardy, you can't have a separate trial for a crime based on that same action?
Okay, I'm already getting the feeling that this is about to get really complicated. What were the main legal principles the court used to try and unravel all of this?
The biggest thing they looked at was something called a Blockberger test. It's a test that's been used in law for a long time to figure out if two offenses are actually different from each other for the purposes of double jeopardy.
Okay, so let's break this down. How does this Blockberger test actually work? I think the listeners would appreciate a clear explanation of how it comes into play here.
It's all about the elements of the offenses. The Blockberger test, what it says is each offense, each one has to require proof of a fact that the other offense doesn't. So basically, to avoid double jeopardy, each charge needs to have something unique about it, something that makes it different from the other charge.
Right. Okay, I get that. But I'm curious to see how this actually played out in Dixon and Foster's cases.
Yeah.
Their situations seem pretty similar at first glance. Can you walk us through how this test led to such wildly different results?
Sure. So let's start with Dixon. You remember, he was convicted of contempt for violating his bond by committing any crime. To prove that, The prosecution, they didn't need to show anything specific about the drug offense itself. They just had to show that a crime happened.
So the contempt charge, it was kind of like, as long as they could prove some crime happened, it didn't really matter what it was.
That's right. Now, compare that to the drug charge. For that, the prosecution had to prove not only that he had the cocaine, but that he had it with the specific intent to sell it. That intent to distribute, that was the key element that the contempt charge didn't have.
Oh, okay. I think I see where you're going with this. So the contempt conviction already proved that a crime happened, which covers one part of the drug charge. But the drug charge had that extra part, the intent to distribute, and that wasn't part of the contempt charge at all.
You got it. And that's exactly where the Blockberger test kicks in. Because that drug charge needed them to prove an extra thing that the contempt charge didn't, they were seen as two separate offenses in terms of double jeopardy.
Okay, that clears up why they were able to go ahead with the drug charge against Dixon.
Yeah.
But then how did it go so differently for Foster?
Well, with Foster, that's where you really see this Blockberger test in action.
Yeah.
He had a bunch of charges from that one incident where he violated the CPO. Let's go through them one by one. So first, there was simple assault. That one ended up being blocked by double jeopardy.
I'm guessing that's because the contempt charge and the simple assault charge, they both basically relied on the fact that he assaulted his wife.
You got it. Proving that Foster assaulted his wife, well, that was enough for both the contempt conviction and the simple assault charge. There wasn't anything else unique they needed for the assault charge. So under Blockberger, they were seen as the same offense for double jeopardy.
Okay, that makes sense. But you mentioned that some of the other charges against Foster were allowed to go forward. What made those different? How did they pass the Blockberger test?
The other two, the threats and assault with intent to kill, those each had something extra, that distinct element that the Blockberger test needs. To prove the threats charge, the prosecution had to show that he made a specific threat, you know, a believable one, against his wife. It had to be more than just the assault itself.
So the threat charge went further than just proving the physical attack. It had to show intent to cause fear, to cause harm.
Exactly. And the assault with intent to kill was kind of the same. It wasn't enough to prove the assault happened. They had to show that Foster was actually trying to kill his wife during the assault. That intent to kill, that was a big deal. It separated it from both the contempt charge and the simple assault charge.
So it sounds like this Blockberger test is all about dissecting the charges, like really looking closely at each little piece to see if there's any overlap or if they're totally separate offenses.
That's a great way to put it. And the Supreme Court, in using this analysis, they made a decision that had a huge impact on the legal world. They decided to overturn Grady v. Corbin.
Hold on. Can we go back for a second? You mentioned Grady v. Corbin before, but I think a lot of people listening might not know about that case. What was the big deal with it, and why did the court overturn it in Dixon?
So Grady v. Corbin created this thing called the same conduct test for double jeopardy. Basically, it said that if a second trial required proving conduct that had already been used to prove the first offense, then double jeopardy was in play. It focused on the actual actions, not just the legal elements.
So Grady had a broader view of double jeopardy, looking at the whole picture of what happened instead of breaking down every detail of the charges.
Right. But in Dixon, the Supreme Court, they decided that same conduct test was just too unclear and unpredictable. It created too much gray area, and they wanted something more clear-cut for courts to use consistently.
So they got rid of the same conduct test and went with the Blockberger test with its focus on the elements because it's stricter and more straightforward.
Exactly. They thought the Blockberger test, since it looks so closely at the statutory elements, it just made things more objective and consistent when figuring out if double jeopardy applies. They wanted to get rid of any confusion and make it easier for courts to handle these tricky situations.
Okay, that makes sense. By zeroing in on those specific parts of each charge, it creates a system that's easier for courts to follow, right?
Right. It makes things less random and ensures that double jeopardy is used fairly and consistently.
So Dixon basically made the Blockberger test the only test for double jeopardy. No more same conduct tests. It's all about the elements. But I bet there were some people who disagreed with that decision, right? Were there any dissenting opinions in Dixon?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Justice Scalia, he wrote the majority opinion. He was all about this strict use of Blockberger, arguing that contempt, even though it's unique in a way, should be treated just like any other crime when it comes to double jeopardy.
Sounds like Scalia, always going for that clear-cut rule. But I'm guessing not everyone on the court agreed with him on that.
You're right. There were some pretty strong dissenting voices. Justices Rehnquist, White, Blackmun, and Souter, they all had issues with the majority's logic. Their point was that contempt is a different beast. It's designed to protect the court's authority, not just to punish someone for something they did.
So they thought that lumping contempt in with every other crime could weaken the court's power to, you know, maintain order and enforce its decisions. That's an interesting argument. Did they say more about that?
They did. They were worried that the majority opinion could make it harder for courts to hold people accountable when they don't follow orders, which could make it harder to make sure people actually do what the courts say.
So it's a balancing act then. On the one hand, you want to protect people from being punished twice for the same thing. But on the other hand, you need to make sure the courts have the power to keep things running smoothly. Right.
You nailed it. And the dissent in Dixon really brought that tension to light, that potential conflict between individual rights and a strong judicial system. They felt like the majority, while trying to make things clear and consistent, maybe went too far in protecting individuals and might have weakened the courts in the process.
So this wasn't just some theoretical legal debate. There were some real consequences at play.
Absolutely. The dissenters even brought up a pretty scary scenario that I think we should consider. They were worried that Dixon could actually encourage people to intentionally get in trouble for contempt as a way to avoid harsher punishments later on.
Wait, so you're saying that someone might deliberately break a court order knowing they'll get slapped with a contempt charge just so they can use double jeopardy to avoid bigger problems down the road?
That was their fear. Think about it. If you know you can only be punished once for something, it might make sense to get that one punishment out of the way early, even if it means purposely doing something to get hit with contempt.
That could cause all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of how that might actually happen? Okay, like, imagine someone's in a domestic violence situation, and they know they're probably going to face some pretty serious charges.
Right.
So they could, like, purposely violate a restraining order knowing they'll get hit with contempt.
Yeah.
And then if the bigger charges like assault or battery come later, they might try to use double jeopardy as a defense, saying, hey, I was already punished for this with the contempt thing.
Exactly. And that's a scary thought. It could create this loophole where people can game the system and avoid the real consequences of what they did. The dissent in Dixon, they were really worried about that the majority opinion didn't really address that risk.
Well, it's a tough spot for the courts, right? They have to make sure double jeopardy is upheld, but also protect against people abusing it. Did Dixon offer any solutions for how to find that balance?
Well, Dixon didn't specifically address that concern. The main focus was on clarifying the Blockberger test as the rule for double jeopardy. But because there wasn't any clear guidance on how to deal with this potential for abuse, it leaves a lot open to interpretation, which could lead to inconsistencies and, you know, people trying to take advantage.
So we're left with a bit of a cliffhanger then.
Yeah.
Dixon answered some questions about double jeopardy, but created new ones, especially about contempt and how it can be used strategically.
It shows just how complex and nuanced double jeopardy law is. Dixon cleared some things up with the Blockberger test, but it also revealed some weaknesses, some areas where we need more clarification.
It sounds like Dixon is going to keep lawyers and legal scholars busy for a long time, trying to figure out all the implications.
For sure. It's a landmark case that has changed the way we understand double jeopardy and forced us to ask some hard questions about fairness, accountability, and the balance of power between people and the courts. There's no easy answer, and the debate will continue as new cases come up and test the limits of our legal system.
So if we had to boil all this down to the key takeaways for our listeners, what would you say are the most important things to remember about United States v. Dixon?
Okay, well, first off, Dixon made it absolutely clear that the Blockberger test is the test for double jeopardy, the same conduct test from Grady v. Corbin. Gone. When deciding if someone can be tried for multiple offenses, courts have to carefully analyze each element of every charge to make sure they are actually distinct.
So no more gray areas. It's all about breaking down each charge piece by piece.
That's it. Secondly, Dixon established that criminal contempt convictions have the same double jeopardy protection as any other crime. This means courts have to be careful about how they use contempt and make sure people aren't being prosecuted multiple times for the same actions.
That really emphasizes how important it is to understand contempt and how it relates to other charges.
Definitely. And finally, Dixon brought to light the possibility that people could try to manipulate double jeopardy, especially when contempt is involved. While the decision itself didn't provide a clear-cut answer on how to stop that, it did stress that courts need to be on the lookout and really scrutinize contempt charges to make sure they're not being used as a way to escape harsher punishments.
So, a lot to think about here. It's a fascinating case that gets at some really fundamental questions about our justice system, fairness, accountability, and the power dynamic between individuals and the courts.
Well said. It reminds us that the law is always evolving, adapting to new challenges and societal changes. Cases like Dixon make us really examine how those changing legal principles affect both individuals and the legal system as a whole.
Thanks for joining us as we took a deep dive into the intricacies of United States v. Dixon. We hope you learned something and maybe even had your mind blown a little. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and keep those legal minds sharp.